Welcome to the Reason Podcast. I'm Catherine Mangue Ward, Editor-in-Chief of Reason. I'm joined today by Naomi Schaefer Riley. Naomi is a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where she studies the foster system, adoption, and religious liberty. She's also a former columnist for the New York Post and the Wall Street Journal, and the author of quite a few books, including An Attack on Tenure, An Investigation into Interfaith Marriage, and a reported book about the mistreatment of Indian Americans by the modern federal government. She recently wrote a feature for Reason magazine where she applied the insights of data-driven predictive analysis to the child welfare system. Today, we're going to talk about what happens when the state gets involved in the raising of children, plus some Washington insider gossip. If you like what you hear, don't forget to subscribe at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for joining us, Naomi.
Thanks for having me.
So today we are going to talk pretty broadly about what I think has not always been your beat. And the first thing that I want to ask you is, why did you find yourself in this area where you're reporting broadly on child welfare, on child endangerment, on adoption, on the foster care system? How did you go from what I think of earlier in your career as kind of a generic political pundit, and I mean that not as
in the nicest possible way,
to a little bit more of a scholar on those issues?
So the two areas that got me into this, the most recent one was my work on Indians. I wrote a book about Native Americans that came out a couple of years ago. And if you know anything about Indian reservations, you know that child welfare is a huge issue in these places. And so what I saw in these reservations was, in some ways, the worst of child welfare in the United States. And it got me thinking about larger issues. I wrote a part of the book about the Indian Child Welfare Act. I was writing a little bit about foster care for that. And the other area that kind of coincided with this was my writing about religion. And in the last decade or so, there's been a big, I would almost say, revolution in the area of churches that have gotten really involved in foster care. You know, a lot of evangelical churches have always been interested in international adoption, but adopting American kids and fostering American kids, who are in need, has really become kind of a big issue on their radar screen in recent years, and they've really started a bunch of different organizations to try to reduce the number of kids in foster care.
There's, I think, a national conversation going on about what the appropriate role of religious organizations is in these areas. I know you know, it's very easy to come across stories which you could really call horror stories, right? People who adopt or foster a whole bunch of kids and bring a very strict religious approach. I think there are some obvious reasons why the media might want to focus on those narratives. But maybe because I know that you often take a quantitative approach to these things, could you talk about the outcomes for kids that are in religiously focused systems rather than the public system? Like, how do those compare? Are people right to be worried, or are there special risks?
Yeah, I think the special risks that come from foster care are not necessarily coming from religious homes. And I haven't seen any numbers comparing, say, parents who identify as non-religious with parents who identify as religious. And frankly, the overwhelming number of people who are doing, foster care and adoption, especially, on a kind of widespread community level, are being driven by their religious beliefs to do it. I've had people ask me this, so I feel like I need to clarify, not that they're trying to bring the children to Jesus, because that's kind of always the question that I get, at least in certain circles, but that they feel like they have an obligation to care for the widow and the orphan. And so if you're going to, you want people to bring children who have huge emotional, medical, behavioral problems into their home, and not just one child, but bring in sibling groups, bring in older sibling groups. I mean, where are you going to find someone who wants to bring 16-year-old boys, who have a history of behavioral problems into a family setting? Oftentimes those kids are really reduced to being put in institutional settings, which really don't have good outcomes, and then aging out of the system. So, from that perspective, I think, the vast majority of these families are really doing amazing work, and one might say God's work. Right, with regard to these kids. And obviously the media is going to focus on this number of But frankly, there are cases every day where you have child abuse, neglect, and fatalities with families that have no religious beliefs at all. And so I think we kind of need to think about who we're attracting to foster care. And that's something that is really concerning to me. I mean, you know, we do give a stipend to people to do foster care. But frankly, you don't want people who are doing foster care for the money. That's actually, I think, a red flag in some ways, if people are sort of taking this. And some people have said that there are people who are sort of now substituting their foster care stipends for a welfare check that they used to get. That to me is a red flag that, you know, this might be a problematic situation.
And yet overall, I think as a person who's generally friendly to markets and, you know, pro-capitalism in at least a very general sense, you would say, well, it's not a red flag when people do other things for money or most other things. What is it? Is it because the money comes in public stipend form, or is there something else going on with, you know, why caring for children, particularly caring for children full time in your home, would be different?
Right. Well, I think, you know, to be frank about it, what we're looking for these children who are, you know, who have experienced an extreme amount of trauma in their lives already, you know, is probably a stable and, to be blunt, stable middle class home for them to live in. And for them to go to a family where, you know, the mother is essentially, you know, because oftentimes, you know, the money is going into the family. If we could do more to voucherize foster care, I think that might be one solution. But essentially, if you're just giving the family cash, you know, that cash could be used for any number of purposes that have really nothing to do with the child. And so, I'm not saying that all foster families, you know, who take payments are doing a bad job, or that they're all, you know, at risk for abusing or neglecting their kids, or they're all trying to siphon money off the top. But I think that ultimately we would prefer families, you know, who are doing this and using the money to, you know, give their kids a little extra, not who are sort of counting the dollars and thinking, I should take in another foster kid so I can get another stipend.
Right. And I think there's also an element of, you know, it's a thing that people don't feel super comfortable talking about that you just said, which is there are lots of reasons why you would favor placing kids in homes of a certain socioeconomic status, and those homes are not always the ones that are most open to taking kids in, unless maybe they think Jesus wants them to, or
right.
Something in that vein.
And it's not, you know, look, I think that part of this is a cultural issue. And if we could change the culture in middle and upper middle class homes across America, regardless of religious belief, to where, you know, if you can't have a child, or if you have children and want more children, we're foster care and FOST adopt, you know, what they call adopting out of foster care, were a regular option where you knew lots of people who did it, I think you could completely change the system. Churches are one mechanism for doing that, because suddenly you look around the pews and you know a lot of people. They also, you know, the innovation that I think they've gotten, which I think is very smart, is not only are they recruiting in the church, but they're also asking families to support other families that are doing fostering and adopting. And it is such a huge undertaking, and parents are often overwhelmed. It's often a lot of pressure on a marriage, that if you have people who kind of sign up with you and say, you know, we will do some babysitting for you, or we will help you with carpooling, or we will help you get your child to different appointments, you know, that is a huge thing. And if you can get more of that, I think you can even do more to retain the kind of foster families that you want over time, rather than having them experience burnout.
So as somebody who worries about when something that seems to be working well independently gets entangled with the state, I think there are people who would critique foster care and adoption care that are managed through the church from the perspective of, no, it should all be the government. But I worry a little bit more about, okay, if the churches were already kind of effectively running their own social aid line, does sinking that system or entangling that system with the generally more flawed public system endanger the success of those adoptions or that foster care? I mean, talk about the kind of parallel systems and how they interact, I guess is what I'm asking.
Right. Well, the kids that I'm talking about, most of the kids that I'm doing research on, are kids who are essentially wards of the state now. So we kind of have to take that as the baseline starting point. These are kids who either have been removed temporarily or permanently from their home. And the only entity that is capable of doing that is the public entity, is the government. So the question then is, what next? Who is going to take these kids in? And I certainly think that the research is in favor of putting them with families rather than orphanages or institutions at this point. So given that, how do you find those families? How do you train those families and how to recruit those families? And what the churches have done is, I think, actually disentangle themselves a little bit. Some of these churches, you know, it's been approved by the state, but they're doing their own training because essentially the state has taken such a we don't care attitude that they're not, you know, I've heard numerous cases of families that will call the state or will call the state government or call their local government office and say, I want to train to be a foster family, and no one will call them back. I mean, you know, people who have gone to training and, you know, by the state and they've been, you know, insulted or their religious beliefs have been insulted or what. And so what the churches have done is said, you know what, you know, these are our people and we know how to bring them in. We are happy to do the training, do the recruitment, do the support, because frankly, the state has done such a terrible job at this. And so I think in the best case scenarios, we give as much of that, you know, that over to private entities. And, you know, I think from a legal perspective, there's no way of getting around that the state is going to ultimately be contracting with or making decisions about these kids who are parentless as a result of, you know, essentially a legal action that their parents were deemed by a court incapable of caring for them or their parents had died or, you know, something else had happened. But once you get past that initial point, I think that the private nonprofits are much better equipped to find and recruit and support foster families.
Are there secular equivalents, secular private foster or adoption agencies that operate domestically that function similarly, or is this pretty uniquely a religious phenomenon?
There are some that are, and we should say that there's different kinds of organizations we're talking about. There are secular adoption agencies and foster care agencies, but the groups that I'm most interested in are the groups that are not just working on the end of the children, that is saying, like, we need to find you someone, but also working on the supply of available families end of this. And on that end, I don't see a lot of secular work going on. I don't see a lot of non-church organizations trying to find and recruit and support the families.
Let's talk a little bit about discrimination, which I think is the other place where this gets tricky. You know, there are questions that people who are, I'm trying to be charitable, people who are sort of concerned about or hostile to religious organizations or religious values who say, okay, well, listen, these groups are going to discriminate in favor of more observant families. They're going to maybe discriminate against either gay kids or gay parents, depending on the church in question. You know, what's your kind of response to that, or what do you think the court's response to that should be? Which, you know, maybe two different answers.
Yeah, I really think that when it comes to these agencies, we should be taking a let a thousand flowers bloom approach. Not just because most of the thousands of flowers, by the way, happen to be religious organizations. And I would be pretty sad to see, you know, like what happened with Catholic Charities in Massachusetts going out of business, essentially in this area, happen elsewhere in the country, particularly in rural areas where there really might only be, you know, a couple of agencies that you're talking about. For them to go under because the state has said, you know, you must place children with a gay family, I think is a real problem. But the way I've come to look at this is really to go back to, you know, the gay marriage debate that we had in this country. I think that what turned a lot of people in favor of gay marriage was the issue of adoption, was saying, are you serious? You would rather have these children, you know, be in an orphanage, an institution, or not find a family than go with two people of the same sex? This is crazy. And I think a lot of people said, you're right. You know, these kids deserve a loving home. And whether that loving home is with two women or two men or a man and a woman, that's fine. And now I feel like we've come full circle. And I think that advocates on the other side should be willing to concede that we want to find home for these children. That's the bottom line. And so if that means that they're placed through a religious organization or an organization that happens to favor, you know, people of one orientation or another, we should say that's okay because it means more homes for the kids. That being said, I think that there are interesting kind of, you know, compromises we could reach in some ways. You know, maybe the religious organization, if they say no to you, they have to refer you to somebody else, you know, who would be able to help you find a child if you wanted to adopt or foster. So I think that there are ways around that. But I really do think if your bottom line here is that these kids need stable, loving homes, we should let, you know, a lot of different kinds of organizations engage in that work.
One thing that's interesting just in the way that you frame that is it's an example of a for the children argument that actually leads to sort of more pluralism and openness, right? Like you don't typically hear people say like, okay, well, the children deserve the best, therefore let's let people make their own choices differently and enable those different types of choices. Normally it's like the children need what's best, therefore no one can buy a big soda.
Yeah,
right?
Yes. There are a lot of different loving, stable homes in this country, and I think we should be trying to get these kids into as many of them as possible.
Talk about how the money flows in these circumstances. And I think I'm sure the answer to that is a million different ways in a million different places. But I think, you know, as a layman, as someone who doesn't know a lot about this, I assume there's a big pool of money somewhere that probably exists mostly at the state level, and deciding how to divvy that up and who's eligible for a check and how those checks move around seems determinative in how much flexibility and optionality there really is in the system. Is that a fair characterization? What am I missing?
Yeah, a lot of this is really done at the state level or the county level. I mean, the federal government has certain guidelines that it has tried to institute, and it's actually amazing how poorly they're followed. But yeah, the money is done at the state level. There are big arguments, in terms of state funding of Department of Social Service, of caseworkers, of training for the caseworkers, of Child Protective Services, of how much money foster parents should get, of who qualifies as a foster parent, whether relatives should qualify as foster parents, if they should get paid. I think that, you know, there seems to be a lot of agreement that there's not enough money in the system, but frankly, there's a lot of evidence that pouring money into the system is not improving things.
She said about every government system everywhere.
I want you to be able to take this clip and just put it on whatever podcast
right.
You'd like. So.
We'll just be pasting you into all further discussions of the military, of the public school system, of the postal service.
Yeah.
Thank you. That was very convenient.
Right. It's sad because you go into like family court and it's the same experience as at the DMV, only there are children's lives, you know, on the line. And I feel like, you know, OK, I could wait a little bit longer to get my license. But really, does this child need to wait another 6 months for another hearing to find out whether they're going to find a permanent home?
Is there you mentioned briefly the case of Catholic Charities in Massachusetts. For our listeners, could you describe how that went down and, you know, is other than that sort of narrow circumstance, is it a cautionary tale that we should be looking, you know, maybe not only in foster care system and adoption, but more broadly in terms of religious freedom and voluntary association?
Yeah, I actually thought there was kind of too little focus on that when it happened. I mean, it seemed like maybe it made big news in certain circles, but, you know, essentially Massachusetts passed its gay marriage statute. And as part of that, there was a whole list of organizations that could not discriminate, and Catholic Charities, which really, you know, is probably the major player in a lot of states when it comes to adoption and foster care, you know, said, look, we can't do this. We're not going to do this. We're not going to buy. I mean, it was, you know, very similar to, the showdown over Obamacare and contraception. Except I think that we should have probably placed a lot more emphasis on that at the time, because frankly, a lot more people could have seen you know, on the ground what the effects of this were. There's a scholar at University of Illinois, Chicago named Robin Fretwell Wilson, and she's been trying to look at kind of the effects of these organizations shutting down on the system. And she has said, you know, particularly, as I said, in more rural areas, you know, you get one of these organizations shutting down and that could really, you know, prove to be a huge problem for a whole state in terms of finding homes. And what we're seeing is the biggest problems and the biggest rise in foster care are often now in more rural areas that are being affected by the opioid crisis. So West Virginia has seen numbers go through the roof, Ohio. I mean, you know, other places, too. But those are places where it also happens to be the case that the providers of foster care and adoption services are mostly religious. And so I don't think that, you know, I think that this needs to be seen in light of, again, you know, is this really the best plan for the kids?
That's actually something I wanted to ask you about. We've our science correspondent, who has also been conscripted to be our Appalachia correspondent, Ron Bailey, has written a lot about, you know, what it means to exist inside the, you know, declining or sort of almost dead economies in some of the places that used to be mining towns, and in particular, and he's. In much of his reporting, there is kind of an aside or a mention about grandmothers and great-grandmothers and aunts taking care of generations of kids, either because their parents have left to look for work or more likely because of, you know, opioid addiction. Those kids, by and large, are in this kind of original state that you described. They've been taken from their parents. The parents are still around. Theoretically could meet the standards for becoming fit parents again at any time. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that's something that makes libertarians nervous, right? This idea that, yeah, of course there are unfit parents, but there's an awful lot of gray area that might look unfit to the eyes of a bureaucrat and might just be unusual or, you know, free-range Lenore Skenazy approved or drug use but not abuse. Yeah. I worry about that. I think about that. You know, what are the standards? How have they evolved? How do we keep them from being too intrusive?
Well, a lot of the kids you're talking about have not been officially removed from their parents' homes at all. I mean, it's merely a casual relationship where a grandmother has stepped in because the parent's not there. And, you know, the state may have some knowledge that that's happened, although in a lot of these places, the state may not have any knowledge at all. I mean, I've been to areas where, you know, a school principal told me that, you know, something like, you know, a quarter of her kids she said between a quarter and a half of the kids in her school are not living with either biological parent. So it's the numbers are so big and so much of this is just going on in a kind of casual, you know, not in terms of the seriousness, but, you know, casual that is not formally legal basis. Mm-hmm. So that I think that's the first thing to keep in mind. The second thing to keep in mind is that a lot of these grandmothers are also suffering from the same kinds of drug issues that the mothers are. This is not like typically an issue that's just, you know, reserved for one nuclear, a single nuclear family and doesn't affect the aunts and the grandmothers, too. So beyond that, in terms of what the standards are, I think that they're very vague I don't think that they're vague in the way that you think they are. I mean, if you go to, you know, particular towns in West Virginia, it's not like mothers are getting arrested because they left their kid in the car while they went into the dry cleaner. That's not, I mean, in these states are so overwhelmed by serious abuse and neglect cases. And you could say that the standards are not clear, but these kids are not getting taken away from homes where they're being well cared for.
I mean, you sometimes do hear the occasional scare story. And I think it mostly is that. I mean, you know, Reason reports on these because it's, you know, for us, it's important to sort of say we want to keep an eye on these things, which are right now isolated incidents, but could be harbingers of a trend. But the stuff we report on that Lenore Skenazy in particular reports on, it's often a story that ended okay. But if you were the parent in that story, it would feel catastrophic. So, you know, kid in his backyard playing basketball for a couple hours after school because he doesn't have a key to the house. The neighbors call it in. You know, the kid was taken away from his parents for a month. He was with an aunt or a grandmother or something. But his parents could only have supervised visits for that month while they untangled the apparatus around this complaint. And we sort of report on also people who have thumbed their noses at authority, like the Metyevs in Maryland.
Right.
Again, like, the kid was in custody, or kids were in custody for a couple hours, you know, basically just at somebody's desk while their parents sorted it out. Not the sort of thing that would show up, I think, in your work in terms of the deep statistical analysis about what this really looks like, but something that maybe our listeners think about or worry about.
Well, I think that, you know, there are definitely reasons to think about that and worry about that. But I just it is a kind of different category from my perspective. I think a lot of those cases are being driven by a helicopter parenting culture. They're being driven by, you know, nosy neighbors who are also involved in helicopter parenting their kids and your kids. And they're reporting them to authorities because they and the authorities have to respond because of what's in the law. So, you know, you can, I think, you know, obviously, you know, Lenore has done great work now in having the first free range parenting law. And so you can change the way the authorities react to that. But the vast majority of the cases that I'm talking about are cases not even where neighbors are reporting anything. There are often cases where it's mandated reporters. So, you know, you have teachers, you have pediatricians, you know, social work, people who, you know, see signs of abuse or serious neglect, and they must call the authorities, you know, no matter what. So I'm hesitant, and I actually think this is an important point to make because these two issues do get rolled into one.
Yep.
And I do want to sort of caution listeners in sort of assuming that the problems that, you know, often middle class Americans are experiencing because of the hyper parenting culture are the same problems that we're talking about when we're talking about removing children from families as a result of accusations of serious abuse or neglect.
So one thing that, you know, people say when they become parents, like their reaction to certain types of media or like maybe they can't watch horror movies anymore, that kind of thing. I have not experienced that. But the one thing I do experience extremely strongly is if I ever read a story about a newborn baby being taken from its parents, I want to die. Like those stories now make me furious and upset in a way that they didn't used to. But I also sort of feel very strongly that, you know, having had a newborn, oh, my God, it would be so easy to completely screw that up.
Mm-hmm.
And possibly fatally so. Can you talk a little bit about sort of newborn and, you know, in particular, like in hospital drug testing, how those decisions get made in that moment? And maybe in particular, even for people on Indian reservations where, you know, as you say, some of this is where you started and where I think it's especially common, right?
Yeah. So I think, you know, the hospital situation has been sort of interesting for me to think about. There's federal legislation and state legislation in most states that actually mandates if doctors suspect that a child has been born substance exposed, that they do testing on the mother to find out, and that there is a, you know, reporting to Child Protective Services if the baby has been born with you know, an illegal substance in their body, and this law is widely ignored. I mean, I've talked to doctors and people who are in charge of hospitals, and I've talked to social workers, and the doctors have this, you know, this fear that if they report this, that this is going to provide a disincentive for mothers to seek prenatal care or even to have their babies in hospitals. And moreover, they also worry that that's, you know, Child Protective Services is such a blunt instrument that they're just going to come in and say, okay, the mother's got pot in her system and we're going to take the baby away. I think that part of the problem here is there is a lack of transparency. So it's one of these cases where it's annoying to me that this law is on the books and it's widely ignored. Like, I think we need to have a discussion about if this is in fact the case, if you know, CPS really is screwing this up and coming in whenever, you know, a baby is born substance exposed and immediately removing no matter what the circumstances, even if the mother is, you know, in treatment or whatever it is. I think that's a conversation we need to have. If the doctor's fears are completely overblown and this was never going to happen, then I think that's a conversation we need to have, because clearly the mothers are going to need some help. I mean, you know, talk about remembering what it was like to have a baby and, like, you know, to come home and trying to be weaning yourself off of drugs while you have a newborn screaming around the clock, like some of these babies who are born with drugs in their system. I mean, that is a situation where you are crying out for some kind of help. And the fact that you would be sent home without some kind of offer of services or support just seems to me insane. So I would like to kind of somehow figure out really what's going on when these babies are born. And I do think that, you know, that if a child is clearly born, you know, substance exposed, that is experiencing all of these symptoms that you hear about, all the shaking as they go through their version of withdrawal, I think that we have to provide some kind of at least offer of help to them. And that has to be there has to be a test done to find out whether, in fact, that's happened and what could be done. Because now the baby is the baby's own person. Like, and we need to be thinking about what's the best treatment for that child. In terms of Indian reservations, I mean, the drug problems are worse. The child abuse and neglect cases are worse. Obviously, poverty is worse. So all of these factors are leading to even more of these problems on reservations. And I don't think that there is enough. And Indian Health Services is just terrible. So the combination of those things, I think, have led to a kind of perfect storm on these reservations. And for years, you've seen higher rates of fetal alcohol syndrome, which leads to all sorts of problems later in life, too. So, you know, it's one of these cases where, you know, I think the worst of the worst really sort of made me think, like, what does the rest of the system look like?
The question of selective enforcement, I think, is, you know, it's one that we think about a lot at Reason with respect to other laws, too. Right. You know, it's not just the doctors don't always enforce it. It's that, you know, different hospitals and different doctors are actually much more likely to do the test and report the test against people of certain races, against, you know, poorer people. Like, I assume that there's a bunch of kind of profiling built into a lot of this, you know, a sort of upper middle class white lady who's, you know, blood is coursing with oxycodone, maybe isn't going to get tested at all and, like, get sent on her way home, whereas the poor heroin addict is much more likely to get caught up in that net. What is there anybody who's doing this right? Is there anybody who there's, like, a model of a system that is sort of supporting people who need support, being judicious and taking kids away, and then allowing diversity in the fostering and adoption end of the system?
I think that there are different pieces of this that are being done well in different states. So one of the places I just came back from was Arkansas. And there are actually a lot of Arkansas is still kind of in the meth crisis. They're like one drug crisis behind the rest of the country.
Cool. They're doing a retro drug crisis.
Exactly right. So it's interesting because I think what they've tried to do is build a number of different organizations that try to attack this problem from different ways. There's a children's hospital in Little Rock that's trying to do a lot with helping mothers who have substance problems treat their babies, be able to stay with their babies, because that's a big thing. And there are other groups that are doing similar work. There's an organization called Freedom House, which is trying to do addiction treatment for mothers, both prenatally and then keeping the mothers with the babies in these homes and sort of following them for the long term. So I think that there are increasingly options for doing that. This sort of method of addiction treatment where you send someone away for a month or you take away their child and send them away, I think is not typically what people think is a good plan anymore. And often, obviously, that leads to depression and all sorts of other issues that will only lead to a relapse in drug use as well. But I think what's interesting about Arkansas is you had this group of mothers who started, middle class mothers who started to do adoption out of foster care. But then they realized there were all sorts of other problems. And so then you had another group that started up trying to do transitioning for kids who were aging out of the system and providing, you know, help with job training or getting their GED or providing counseling. And so people can come there now. They have a drop-in center where people can come and take lifestyle classes, life skills classes, you know, cooking or toasting things, you know, just things that they never learned because they were never in a home. You know, some of these kids I talked to had been in homes of, you know, 30 different homes over the course of their lives. So never enough stability there.
I'm sorry, when you said toasting things, yeah. Was that explicitly a meth addicts take apart the toasters reference?
No.
Because I could imagine.
No, I should have said
toasters might be hard to come by.
How to boil an egg. I'm sorry. Those kind of life skills, not taking apart toasters. And then they started to think, you know, look, our goal is not just to take these kids away from their biological mothers. And so they started providing mentorship opportunities for the actual biological mothers and tried to help them find jobs and housing and things like that. And so it's a whole group of different organizations that are trying to attack the problem from different ways. They have different offices where there's essentially like a thrift shop, you know, and everybody who's doing fostering can come and take clothes or, you know, formula or whatever it is they need, because fostering can be very expensive, even if you are receiving a state stipend. Maybe, you know, if you're think of how much you spend and how fast your kids grow. Like, and now think that you just have that child for 6 weeks, maybe. Like, are you going to go buy them a whole new wardrobe? So it's, I think that there are ways that there's areas where they have a good grip on the problem and are trying to come at it from a lot of different ways.
And is that group in Arkansas that you're describing, is that church-based? Is it affiliated with a particular church, or is it just ecumenical?
It's mostly evangelical churches, but different Protestant denominations. It's actually interesting. I've increasingly had the sense that Catholic churches are not as involved in this issue as you would think. And I've wondered aloud, and I have no way of proving this, but I think that the Catholic Church has kind of outsourced this to Catholic charities. Like, I think they kind of professionalized this in a way. And whereas the evangelical churches have always had like more of a grassroots sense of, you know, that and so they feel sort of much more of individual obligation to go out and foster and adopt.
You could probably draw lots of metaphors about the varying doctrines.
That's
there,
true, right?
Which I won't do since I am not qualified for
there
that.
There you go.
But I do wonder in kind of professionalizing and creating a separate institution to do some of these charitable works that exposed the Catholic Church to what, or that exposed Catholic charities to what happened in Massachusetts, right? If they had been doing some of this work totally in-house, like literally in the church, that would have made a legal difference, right? From the perspective of at least
a little bit, maybe. I mean, I think, you know, I think any time that you now it's just a question of the state assuming risk. So I did a piece recently about a group called Safe Families, which is basically exists outside of the foster care system. And it's, a family in need. You know, maybe there's an addiction problem. Maybe they're going to be homeless. Maybe the person is out of a job, or the, you know, mother needs even just hospitalization for, you know, for some serious surgery. And she, let's say she has no family nearby and no friends who are willing to take in her child. She can go to Safe Families and say, I need some help. And they have volunteers who will say, take in your child for 6 weeks or a month. And the state has no involvement because you're never actually giving up custody of your child. So this to me is, you know, on the other hand, you know, a lot of states want to regulate that. So New York, for instance, Safe Families cannot, families, volunteers cannot take children into their homes overnight. even though the children are not leaving their custody, because the state of New York has said, no, 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 you're operating as a pretend foster care agency, and that's a liability, and so you need to be licensed to do that. And so even though these families who are volunteering have gone through background checks and training and all sorts of other stuff, that's not enough. So in a sense, you would think that, well, if we make this more of like a home-based thing something that exists outside of the foster care system, we should be fine. But, you know, states are, as you know, encroaching. You can use that clip, too.
And this is, I mean, yeah, this, of course, is something we write about all the time, right? Like, public services crowd out direct private competitors. And I was thinking when you were describing that Arkansas example, that it sounds like a government agency, right? It is essentially like a series of functions that might have been performed by several different interrelated government agencies being performed instead by several different interrelated private entities.
Right. And as a result, they're more efficient and competent. And I would say probably are providing more stable and loving help to these kids than the bureaucracy would.
Let's turn our attention to Washington, where we are, where you have come from your native New York for some kind of pilgrimage, no doubt. You are a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. We were greeted this morning with the news that Paul Ryan is resigning, not just as speaker, but from his seat, and will ride off into the sunset at the end of this term. A lot of speculation he might be coming to AEI. Would you greet him as a liberator?
I don't have anything to say about the speculation, but I like Paul Ryan, and I think he probably shares a lot of the views that AEI does, and I think, you know, his you may have your own way of judging his success, but I think that his work on trying to change poverty in this country is important, and I think he's put in a good faith effort.
This is obviously a point of conversation because Arthur Brooks, the current head of AEI, has announced he's stepping down, so the job is theoretically open. Let's talk a little bit about Paul Ryan's legacy while we're here, because it's kind of on everyone's mind. I scrounged up a piece that I wrote in 2003 when I was working at the Weekly Standard, which is, I think it cannot be described any way other than a puff piece. It was a very generous profile written by a very young journalist about a very young congressman who had just arrived in Washington, and he was handing out copies of Atlas Shrugged and talking a lot about how he was going to get the nation's fiscal health in order. Paul Ryan has been a journey of into disappointment for me in many ways. Talk a little. I mean, you seem a little more positive on his legacy. Talk about what that guy has done.
Well, maybe I was just less wide-eyed than you were to begin with.
That's possible. To be honest, I was very bright-eyed and bushy-tailed when we both arrived here in D.C. So
no, I don't. I'm actually not. Despite your early impressions, I'm not a general political pundit. So I just think it's very hard to change Washington. I don't think anyone, despite their claims, is actually doing anything to drain the swamp. I think that he has the right ideas, but ultimately he's one congressman, and I don't get the sense that he's changed his principles, or that he's sacrificed them more than a lot of other people have. But I actually, you know, maybe that work is just it's not going to get done in Washington. I don't know. I wish I had something more useful to say on this topic. But I think he's, like I said, put in a good effort, and I don't know.
E for effort, Paul Ryan. No, I mean, I guess, you know, I think.
I think he has a fundamentally better understanding of why we have poverty than 99.9% of people in Washington. So that's a good start.
And yet he is perhaps the most frequently accused in Washington of not caring about the poor.
That's our political environment. I mean,
that's Paul Ryan meme, right?
Right.
He wants to take the can of cat food away from Granny and shove the orphans out of the way. The corporations, probably. What is it that Paul Ryan understands about poverty that he will take with him and perhaps leave Washington?
Well, I think he understands that poverty is a cultural issue, not just an economic one. I think he understands that government is probably not going to solve poverty on its own, and that government often makes poverty worse. And if you had politicians who understood those three things populating Washington, we would have a totally different federal approach to all sorts of policies.
Is there anything in the offing legislatively that is promising to your eye in the general area of, I mean, we could talk about poverty reduction generally, but I was going to kind of circle back to these issues of child welfare and foster care and adoption. Typically, these things happen at the state level, but are there any reforms that you see out there that are promising?
This legislation called Family First passed a couple of months ago. It's not a huge amount of money, but it actually gives states some flexibility to take money that would be going to foster care and put it into more preventive service programs. The federal government is going to have to approve what those programs are. So this is going to be a long process, and I'd be totally speculating. But I think that there are a lot of good preventive services programs out there that sort of say to families in crisis, you know, we can help you in these different ways to prevent us from having to take your child away. And I think if we can obviously get these families upstream from the CPS worker enters your house and says, you know, what are you doing? That would be a great innovation. Like I said, it's still a small amount of money. But I think on the whole, giving states more flexibility when it comes to these funds is a better idea because, of course, they know, you know, these communities know better about what's working on the ground than some guy in Washington does.
What do you say to people who would respond that some of these early interventions sound a little bit too much like Minority Report, pre-crime policing type interventions? I mean, where is the line for you between offering services before it gets to a major catastrophic intervention versus messing around in people's private lives before they've crossed a line?
I guess I don't. They're not often punitive. The services that are being offered are sort of, you know, home visiting programs where a nurse will come and sort of offer you. And a lot of them are just voluntary. You're leaving the hospital with the baby. Do you want a nurse to come visit you over the next few weeks, you know, to help you with nursing or what to do when the baby's crying or, you know, these kinds of things. And for mothers who are, you know, in some communities, these are just offered to everyone. And in some communities, you know, it's sort of doctors saying, like, this mother is, you know, on medication for depression. This mother is, you know, tested positive for drugs, you know. So the question is, you know, should we specifically offer these services to people who are, you know, obviously much more likely to have this crisis? And, you know, you could say we should offer them to everyone just so it doesn't look like we're targeting specific people. But frankly, I think that it's a waste in a lot of cases. And so do you really need to do that?
This is also the same argument about whether entitlements should be broad-based so that the middle class supports them generally or whether they should intervene with the least well-off, right?
Yes.
Once again,
yes.
Naomi Schaefer Riley offering the soundbite that applies to everything here on The Reason Podcast.
You can pay me later.
This has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining me on The Reason Podcast. This has been Catherine Mengu Ward talking with Naomi Schaefer Riley about child welfare, adoption, religious freedom, and Paul Ryan, everybody's favorite. If you liked this podcast and you want to hear others like it, go to iTunes where you can subscribe. You can also rate and review The Reason Podcast while you're there. Thank you for listening.